there, Green Future Growers. Thanks for joining us today. If you're new to the show, I hope you'll subscribe on iTunes or your favorite Android app, and let's get growing.
Anyway. I don't know. Anyway.
How's your day going?
Things are going pretty well. How about you?
They're going better.
Good.
It's been a rough couple of weeks.
Oh.
But, no, are you in, like, north of Seattle? Is that where you're at?
We are in Seattle. Are you familiar at all with Seattle?
Vaguely. It's fascinating because my students love, like, I have one kid who draws the Space Needle, like, every day.
Oh.
I teach second grade, and he's just, like, obsessed with it. And he's, like, a really good artist, so they look very detailed, just out of his head.
Wow. That's
I've been there a few times.
Yeah. We're just near we're just a little west of the university, and which is just a little bit north of downtown Seattle.
Oh, okay.
So, in terms of Space Needle, we are we're probably 20 minutes by car from the Space Needle north.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we can't see it or anything like that, but yeah.
Are you all right? No. Is it Bickle? Is that how you say your last name?
Last name is pronounced Bickley. There's an accent over the E.
Well, I saw that, like, I kind of copied and pasted what's it called? Like, the biography from Amazon. And so it has it there. It has the little, okay, so Bickley, okay. And then, so I always like to tell everybody when I first started, I don't know if you've done a lot of podcasts, but because it's recorded, like, it's really easy to edit. So, like, if you need a drink, you need to, like, get your husband a cup of coffee, go to the bathroom, want to change an answer, rethink something, take your time. It's super easy to edit. So, and it's usually really fun. I started my podcast 2 years ago, and then this year, a bunch of principals called me and I ended up going back to teaching second grade full time. So it's been kind of tough to teach and keep my podcast going.
I bet.
So I haven't put out as many episodes since September. Like, before, I was putting out like 8 episodes a month consistently, up to 12 episodes a month. And so this year it's been hard. Like, some months, I think in February, I only had one episode or October or something. Like, it's been really hard because teaching just takes every minute. Like, and even since like 11 o'clock yesterday, when my kids got off their math test for the end of April, you know, we're all like pushing the, you know, make sure they're ready to go to third grade and everything, and just, you know, it's all based on test scores, you know, that's where they decide. And so I'm still like, did they raise their scores 10% or not, because this number's up and this number's down and this number's like, and what's the average, and like, I think we did it, I'm pretty sure we did it, but like, I can't 100% concretely say yes, we raised them 10%. Like, what is that? How can that be? Should it just be a simple like yes? But I don't know, it's like one number and it changes, and one day they're, I don't know. Anyway, I'm not thinking about school and think about my podcast. And it's such a great day to interview you, because I'm just listening to the climate march in Washington, D.C. on the news. So that's kind of exciting that that's going on. Naomi Klein was just talking. I think she was talking last night, but they had it recorded.
Great.
So have you heard about that? You know, the 350.org climate march today. And then last week was the scientists. And so we're going to talk about soil, which has been like on my show has been, you know, a total theme, you know, healthy soil. It all starts with healthy soil. And I actually have interviewed two soil scientists on February 24th, Dr. Elaine Ingham, who's one of the most respected, you know, biggest soil scientists of the time. And then Kathy Olson, who wrote The Soil Will Save Us. And both of those are still in my, like, bank from February 24th. I interviewed them. Kathy's is going up hopefully Monday. I'm, like, almost done with it, ready to post. And then Dr. Ingham's hopefully will be next weekend. I'll get it done. And then I'm so behind. There's been a couple other great, like, this people that have this company called Pit Moss, which is like this environmentally friendly, like it's almost like a newspaper, shredded newspaper that you put in your soil and it helps retain moisture. It's all made from recycled materials. And they sent us a bag, and Mike's been using it, and it's been amazing how it really, like, we're both at first, we were like, what is this? And when I did the interview, I didn't really know. Mike hadn't really opened the bag, we hadn't tried it, but my stuff in my classroom, because I'm in the garden club, so the stuff in the classroom, so I see it every day, and how much it, like, how much less water. And anyway, so I'm so excited to talk to you. It's funny because so you and your husband, is it right? You've written three books now?
Yeah, we kind of ended up with this trilogy. And we think about it as in dirt. That was like, oh man, that's the plight of soil on our planet, and it's not good. You know, for the last 10,000 plus years, we've been ripping into our soil with plows and trowels and shovels and bulldozers and all this stuff, and that's about the worst thing you can do for soil is start digging around in it and start moving it around. So anyway, that's the story in dirt, the plight of our soil. And then in The Hidden Half of Nature, which Dave and I co-authored, he solo authored Dirt. The Hidden Half of Nature is this just amazing new area of science where we're finally able to see into the microbial world. And I'm using see metaphorically because, of course, the microbial world is invisible, but we now have tools and techniques, or scientists do at least, that they're employing to look at all of these just amazing symbiotic relationships that go on between plants and microbes in the soil. And as we also cover in the hidden half, the human microbiome, especially what's going on in our guts. And, you know, both we and plants are really kind of chimeric organisms, you know, meaning that we're an amalgamation of life forms. We've got, you know, all our own cells, and a plant has all of its own cells, but we also each haul around a good number of microbes that help us live and keep us alive. And so the hidden half of nature is insights and understanding about healthy soil and healthy body. And then Dave's got a book coming out May 9th, so just around the corner, called Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. And that book is kind of solving the problem that got talked about in Dirt using the science that we unveiled in The Hidden Half of Nature. And I just think any gardener or farmer that's done any of that for any length of time would not be surprised at all about the sort of progression of things, you know, that we've really hammered the soil, but that it's possible to also, you know, investigate and understand and learn how the soil works. And then you can apply all of that. And, you know, as we like to say, you know, let's bring soil back to life. So that's the Dirt Trilogy.
Nice. Okay. So, and I'm interviewing him next Saturday, right?
I think so. Yeah, I'm not
Cool.
sure if he's signed up with you or not
Yeah,
yet,
he
but
did. I'm pretty sure. I
did he?
was
Oh,
just looking on my phone.
yeah.
I usually like know exactly when and everybody, and now it's like the alarm goes off and I'm surprised if like an interview. I'm like, oh wow, because my hours, like people have to be so flexible. You know, my hours are like either 6 o'clock in the morning before school on a weekday Montana time,
Yeah.
or which the East Coasters isn't too bad because that's 8 o'clock in the morning their time,
Yeah.
or the weekends. So, and it's just oh, it's been crazy. Anyway, and then did you have any questions for me?
Oh, I don't, yeah, where does one find your podcast?
Oh, well, it's on iTunes, or if like you're an Android, it's on there's like a app you can download called Podcast Addict that I use. I think there's others. You can it should be on Stitcher, it should be on I think there's like a Google Play now or Google
Yeah.
Podcast app it's on. And then I don't know. I know my podcasting group, they've been talking about Apple's going from iTunes to Apple Podcast, and I might have to do
Oh.
something there. But I know I still have iTunes and like the episodes keep posting there. So I think I'm still good.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. As soon as
And then
you.
you can also go to my website, the Organic Gardener Podcast, and it will play there just
Oh.
like on any browser.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure like if I go to Google Analytics, it tells me most people download from iTunes, but then the second one is they look on desktops and download it from I want to say Google Chrome. We'll just I think
Sure.
I feel like you're like my new friend already. Like that's the thing I love about podcasting. It's just you make friends all over, and I feel like we already like have a lot in common and just been talking pretty nicely. I don't know if you feel that way,
Yeah.
but it's
No,
fun.
this is the weird, this is the there's so many angles to the interwebs and the digital world. And I think one of the better ones is when you connect with people that you otherwise would not even know about.
I know. My mom complain like people complain all the time, like, oh, everybody's so into their phone and they don't know how to communicate anymore. And I'm like, I don't know. To me, like communication is like the key to communication. Like now I communicate with people that are similar to me instead of just because you live next door, or just because you live across the street. You know, like now I find friends from all around the world and close
Yeah.
ones. Like even like here in Montana, like I joined a hiking group because I live right by Glacier National Park. And so
Oh.
I've met women. And then I've met other women that like live in Kalispell and Whitefish that, you know, they've lived there and I didn't know them until I started my podcast and they live, you know, very close to me. And then
Yeah.
there's other people in Australia and New
Yeah.
Zealand that I've I mean, it's just to me, I think it's the greatest thing. I love Facebook. I was telling my students the other day, we need to find a Facebook for kids, you know, because I'm just such a proponent of Facebook. I just think it's been the greatest thing. I feel very blessed because my Facebook feed is very positive. I have most people are, you know, it's kind of like my podcast. Just, you know,
Yeah.
people who are changing the world in a positive manner. I know other people, you know, they're like, oh, all people post is like, what did I eat today? And snapshots of that. But I only have one friend who really posts what she ate today. And it's usually, she has these really cool vegan meals. I mean, I guess I have some people that post barbecues and things. I don't know. But most of my friends. Anyway, enough about me. Let's hear your wisdom. So I'm going to introduce you and then we'll just go from there.
All right.
Okay. Welcome, green future growers. It's April 29th, 2017 today. It's the day of 350.org's Climate March on Washington, D.C. So I was just listening to that on the news this morning. Super excited. Watched and listened to the Science March on Earth Day last weekend. And the news was just exciting while I was doing my lesson plans. And so it's kind of a great time. To be alive, a little scary at times, but for the most part, I think it's just very optimistic. There's so many people speaking up for our planet together. And so I'm super excited to introduce my featured guest today, Anne Bickley. Anne, are you ready to dig into it?
I am totally ready to dig into it, Jackie.
And it's just a perfect day because Anne Bickley is a biologist and an environmental planner. Her career spans the fields of environmental stewardship, habitat restoration, and public health. And she wrote a book with her husband, who I'm going to get to interview next week, and I'm pretty excited. But their book is called The Hidden Half of Nature. And we're going to talk about soil, which, you know, has been a key to my show. They have a website called digtogrow.com. And I'm going to be try to be quiet and let her tell us about herself and their book and some things about the soil that I think you're excited to. So, welcome to the show, Anne.
Yeah, thank you, Jackie. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you for coming on a Saturday and putting up with my schedule and just we've been having so much fun in the pre-chat. So, go ahead and tell listeners a little bit about yourself. We were talking you're in S Seattle, Washington, right? Just like right out in the city
Yeah.
or
Yeah, that's right. David and I live in just north of downtown Seattle. Excuse me. And yeah, I have to say that this time of year, I was outside way too late last night trying to keep up with the garden. And there was something that occurred to me, and I thought, oh my God, I know this must be what farmers feel like at harvest time, when it's like you just, plants do not wait for you. They just do their thing. And in my case here, it's at the other end of the season, spring, and I have, I'm kind of a little bit crazy with maple trees, and I have a number of maple trees, different kinds of maples that are in pots. And really, some of these I need to be hauling them out of their pots and doing a little root work on them and then replanting them. And I'm like, dang it, they're already just a little too far leafed out to be pulling them out of their pots and messing around with their roots. So, then I was looking around at something else going, oh my God, that thing opened up now. And oh, geez, look at that. That's opening up now. So that is the wonderful world of gardening, is trying to keep up with nature.
Oh, I know. My husband's been complaining all week because he's so wants to get out there, and it's just been raining. He said 3 mornings in a row, it was just downpouring.
Yeah. And something very exciting happened this week, Jackie. Let me tell you about it.
Okay.
Anyone who reads The Hidden Half of Nature, or you happen to come by the garden or check out our website. Oh, and by the way, I want to say the website is Dig to Grow, and it's the word dig and then the number 2 and then grow. Yeah, digtogrow.com. And anyway, I am a big proponent of using organic matter in the garden to keep the soil microbiome happy, well-fed, so that it can do all of the things that it does for our plants. And one of my favorite ingredients, organic matter-wise, for either using straight up as is or mixing it up with a few other things, is wood chips. And in Seattle, you can get free wood chips, but there's also a lot of gardeners in Seattle, so there is a lot of demand for free wood chips. So I usually, around this time of year, get on the phone with arborists and beg and plead and come on, can't you bring some? Come on. And my luck has not been good the last several years, and it's been pretty slim pickings around the garden for wood chips. And finally, 3 days ago, I called an arborist that I'd bothered before, and I said, oh yeah, you know, and then I start to sound all whiny, and I'm like, oh no, don't do that. Oh, can I please have some wood chips? Well, anyway, I got a call back like 3 hours later. Hi, this is Jason from blah, blah, blah tree service, and I'm ready to drop the chips. Where do you need them? I'm like, oh my God, Jason, I love you. Aww. Yeah, here's where you're going to drop them. So he comes over. My neighbor and I, we're kind of partners in crime with the organic matter stuff. His name's Len. He's a 70-year-old painter, and I got to tell you, if we can all do as much as he does when we're 70, I will be happy. Anyway, Len's got this big driveway. It's got an RV parked on one side of it, and Jason pulls in with the wood chips, and he dumps them, and it's almost as big as the RV.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, oh boy. And then, you know, he pulls away and we're thrilled to have the chips. And I have to tell you, in the past, we've gotten chips from arborists. And this is a, you know, cautionary note for gardeners out there. You get what you don't pay for, right? So these wood chips are free. And in the past, we have gotten some kind of cruddy stuff in the wood chips, but you kind of pick around it and you don't use all of it. But these wood chips, they are like, I mean, just primo. It's got a really nice grind on these chips. There's no big chunks of wood. There's no bamboo or blackberry or other crud in these chips. I mean, Leonard and I are giddy. I posted it on our Twitter feed, which is at Dig to Grow, again, the number 2 there. And you'll see the big pile of mulch. I mean, seriously, Leonard and I are just like pleased and tickled. So we have about 6 to 8 yards of wood chips now, and Leonard's only condition is that they be moved out of his driveway by May 31st. So we have a month. We have a month to do that. And anyway, so that's my sort of just very, very exciting thing this week is having scored those wood chips. Very excited about that.
And they just bring them to you for free?
They just want
to get rid of them. They need to get rid of them. And so they're happy to have a place to dump them.
Yes, they need to get rid of them. And they don't want to have to drive to some kind of a dump facility and dump them because they get charged money to dispose these wood chips. And I think it's crazy anyway that we've got any sort of incentive for a business like an arborist to be throwing away perfectly good organic matter. That's just a complete crime, in my opinion. I mean, this is good, clean stuff. It's not like, you know, it's not like other things that you sometimes run into with the gardening and nursery industry. There's been, you know, this is really clean stuff. So anyone out there listening, contact your, you know, every town's got, most every town anyway's got some kind of tree service for arborist, and give them a call and say, hey, what do you do with your chips? Wondering if you can drop a batch off for me.
Oh my goodness, you're dropping golden seeds like crazy already. I love it. Okay, well, that's good to know. I'm sure lots of listeners are like, what? I can just call somebody and they'll bring me some organic matter to add to my compost or to my soil. Yeah. Okay, so, and I do usually like to start off the show asking about like your very first gardening experience. Like, were you a kid? Were you an adult? Who were you with? Would you grow? Like, did you grow up in Seattle? Where are you from?
Yeah, no, actually, I grew up in the Denver metro area of Colorado and lived there all my life until I moved away from college. But my first gardening experience, I think I remember maybe being really, really little, like maybe 4 or 5 or something like that, and helping to plant some flowers. That was kind of my... Hi there.
Sorry, it just happens. But yeah, Skype's no free, problem. So I never complain.
Nope.
Okay, so you were saying you were helping to plant some flowers when you were a little girl?
Yeah, my first gardening experience. Helping to plant some flowers in June sometime. And then I would say that's just kind of like this little tiny memory. What I remember most is being a little bit older, maybe around 11 or 12, and my dad would take me to Ardano's Flowerland, and that was a big nursery. Anyone who's from the Denver area may or may not remember that place. It was along Santa Fe Avenue, and those were the days when Santa Fe, might be Santa Fe Boulevard. Anyway, it had a big, wide shoulder that was not paved. It was just kind of dirt, but it was wide. It was wide enough that there were businesses up and down Santa Fe, and you'd pull off the paved part of the road onto this really, really wide dirt shoulder. And that's where Dardano's Flowerland was. And I remember walking into that place, and it was flowers as far as the eye could see.
Aww.
And we would get a big cart, and he'd load up a few things, and then he'd say, go get whatever you want. And so here I am, I'm like walking around in Flower Disneyland and pulling things off the tables and putting them on the cart. And then we get home and there was a little front garden. I grew up, you know, it was pretty much a suburban environment. I don't know how big the lot was. It wasn't like an acre or anything like that. Maybe a quarter acre, eighth of an acre, something like that. Anyway, there was this small garden right alongside the driveway that was a garden that you walked past as you went to and from the house. And it was just always in daily sight. So that was the one that I always planted up with the Dardano's flowers. And it was things like, I mean, it was completely common things, Jackie. It wouldn't be like knocking anybody's socks off today, but there was just something about early June being outside, is warm, having the hose nearby, my hands in the dirt, and all of these gorgeous flowers. And it was a complete hodgepodge, right? I remember marigolds and petunias and snapdragons and all of that stuff. And so that was my first, I kind of did that annually around the house for, you know, like I said, probably from the age of 10, 11, or 12, all the way through high school. And then things got kind of out of hand inside the house. You can probably appreciate this living in Montana. So, of course, there is no gardening in the wintertime. I started an indoor plant collection that I was looking at some pictures a while back. And I'm like, oh, wow, I'd sort of taken over the living room with all of the plants. I didn't really remember that. But the gardening habit will take you. If you have plant lust bad enough, you'll figure out how, when, and where to grow plants any way you can.
You know, I was just like, just before I got home this morning, we ran to town, and then I went over to my friend Nola's, who was like, I don't know, way back when I first started my podcast, she came on and talked about houseplants. I was just at her place, and she has an aloe plant blooming. Have you ever seen an aloe plant bloom? It's got this huge, like, shoot sticking straight up, and then this giant flower on top. It's just the most incredible thing I ever saw.
I do not believe I have ever seen an aloe in bloom. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was neat. So, from house plants to outside, that's so interesting. My stepdaughters get married in Denver this summer. And then thinking of Denver. And then what was the other thing I was going to say about? I can't remember. Something about Colorado. But, yeah. Oh, well, that's interesting. Growing up in the suburbs. I grew up in the suburbs, too. I grew up in New York. But, yeah, Denver. And going, oh, I know what I was going to say. We just took the garden club of second and third graders to this nursery down in Kalispell near me, and walking through, and I was like, of course, I have to like add some math. So I'm like, look at this array of, like, you know, look at this plant holder, look at this array of flowers, and look at this array of flowers, and look, here's an array of 10 times 10, you know, and I'm just like trying to incorporate math into the, but it was just, the kids just love smelling the, they had tons of geraniums, which was really nice, which is one of my favorites, because like, you might not know it, but my listeners know, my husband's really the gardener, like, and I love geraniums because it's something I can't kill. I can like keep a geranium growing. I plant sunflowers, and like, although this year with the garden club, I have more stuff growing than I've ever planted before from seed. We have, like, in my classroom, it's so funny, I have a windowsill full of snapdragons and lettuce, and we got this guinea pig, so the lettuce is growing for the guinea pig. And what else do we have in the window? Oh, some tomato plants. But anyway, oh, well, that's sweet. That's so sweet that your dad, what a nice memory of you going with your dad to the store and then getting to plant them around your house.
Yeah.
So then is that how you learned how to grow garden organically, or like, was that after you went to school and got your biology degree, or like, where did you like,
it's, here's a true confession, Jackie. So around the house and doing, I will tell you this, after planting all the flowers that I had brought home, my father would always insist, okay, it's time to fertilize them. Here's the miracle grow. So there I was dutifully, you know, mixing up miracle grow in a watering can and watering all the flowers, because that's what you did, right? Plants needed fertilizer. So there was no example of organic gardening in my household. I would say, you know, it was a pretty typical, pretty typical. You fertilize plants and you poison weeds. Now, we weren't, you know, throwing chemicals around or anything like that, but there are weed killers, you know, in the outdoor shed. I wouldn't ever use them, mostly because I just, that had no beauty or joy in it to me. So, but, you know, my dad would ask my brothers to do stuff, or he'd do it. So that was not a model of organic gardening that I grew up with. I would say around the house, though, you know, mostly the yard was sort of an area of benign neglect. Mostly benign neglect, unless something was really getting out of hand, which, I don't know. It's interesting now that I'm saying this, because that's kind of my little bit of my approach around my garden here in Seattle, although you got to be really careful in Seattle because if things grow like crazy here. And so if something gets out of hand, you're kind of like, whoa, when did that happen? So I've got to stay on top of out here with all the rain and water and stuff. But my start in organic gardening, I'd have to say, now that I'm thinking about this, it's mostly self-taught. Now, it helped a lot, Jackie, that when I went to college, it was at the University of California in Santa Cruz, which if anybody knows anything about that town and that campus, you kind of, you know, just take in organic in lots of different senses and thoughts just by osmosis. So it was my sort of exposure to, and this was a while ago, okay, this was 20 years ago that I was in school at UC Santa Cruz. And it
that's
was,
interesting, because like I was in Santa Cruz the only time, I think like 20, 25 years ago when I was in college. I can't remember. I went to like, it was like Redwood Summer, and I went down there all by myself. Do you remember that? Redwood Summer, when the other environmentalists and the hippies were there doing.
I remember that event. That would certainly be an event that would take place in Santa Cruz. Definitely. Redwood Summer. Yeah. There was something that was at the base of campus called the Farm and Garden Project. And I lived off campus after my first year, and I would ride my bike up to campus to get to class. And every day I'd ride past the Farm and Garden Project, and there it was off to my left. And I could see that it was this little oasis. And I would go over there, and I would walk into the area that was the garden, and it would just blow my mind. I mean, you had, I'm not kidding you, it was like some kind of sprightly fairyland between the butterflies and the bees and the dragonflies and all of these. And this would be, you know, during spring. This wasn't year round. This is like spring quarter when things are really just, you know, bursting into growth. But all of these pollinators, and then there were the farm and garden apprentices, and they were like these sprightly fairies too, not like me, the stressed out student, you know, sweating on her bicycle up to her biology class to go sit inside the classroom and learn about cells or something like that. I'm like, oh my god, these people look so happy. I so want to do that. But no, I'm going to get back on my bike and, you know, go up the hill. It was like, it was just sort of this very magical place. Now, I also know that, you know, just from gardening, any gardener out there knows it, that there's a lot of elbow grease and a lot of hard work. So I was not seeing that at the farm and garden. I was seeing just amazing plant growth, these otherworldly type people, insects, pollinators. I mean, That to me was always a very magical experience, to walk into the farm and garden, and anybody could. And so I just walked around, and it was a huge de-stressor for me to go over there and just take 10 or 15 minutes and go poke around and see what was growing. And so that was where I think I really began that. Those were the years, you know, early 20s, where you began to see that there's different ways to have a garden and different ways of eating and different ways of interacting with the world and with society and so on. And so I'm pretty much self-taught. And I think any organic gardener knows also, I mean, you can spend a lot of money on products at the nursery if you want to, but in your 20s, typically you just don't have any money. So and every rental place that I live, none of us had money to go buy, you know, some fertilizer or some product at a nursery. It was pretty much, we're buying the plants and then we're going to figure out how to make them live and grow. And that, so by, you know, that is pretty much how I came upon my, you know, organic gardening experience. And with every garden and every plant, you learn something about yourself and you learn something about those plants. I would have to say that as well. And that's the really neat thing about when you've every gardening season you build on what you've learned in the past. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's interesting. See, now I have to say, my mom was a big organic, and like, I always, like, I still, to this day, I'm like, didn't everybody grow up with like a compost container on their kitchen? Like, I remember going to college, my very first experience of like putting the compost, the like, carton of milk on the, and being like, we're going to keep our compost in here. My roommates being like, huh? But I grew up that way. But my mom was a big organic gardener right from the start. But I can totally relate to what you're saying about going. I love the story about the magical, the fairies and sprites and Santa Cruz. And definitely learn. We always learn. Like, even my husband, I thought when I started my podcast, like, he would just teach people. Like, when I joined the podcasting group, he would just teach people because he's been doing it for 40 years. And still, we're just always constantly learning things as we expand on our place and as we try new things. And then as the weather changes, I mean, it's just, you know, things that you knew 10 years ago to be true are certainly not true anymore. So,
yeah. Yep, absolutely.
So, do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year or grew well last summer?
Yeah, let's see. Well, it's always so my garden here in Seattle, it's a mix of ornamentals and vegetables. Mm-hmm. I have to say that probably if we lived somewhere else, I would dedicate more garden space to growing food. I feel so blessed and fortunate to live in a place that has some really decent farmers markets. So,
yes.
And that's been going for maybe at least the last five, maybe pushing 10 years, maybe not quite. So I feel like, you know what, I can get really, really decent quality, freshly harvested.
Probably.
Yeah. Freshly harvested food at the farmers markets. So, and when you're crazy for plants like I am, it's like, okay, well the farmer's got the food covered, at least where I live. And there's just so many wonderful plants that I'm like, I'm going to grow all of these other things because I like to do that. But I will say that, I guess here's what I would say. I've been really interested in trees lately. I wonder if your listeners, it's also coming up on Arbor Day. Did you know that?
I heard,
I think it's tomorrow and. Well, I'm not exactly, it's, I don't know if it's May 1st. Anyway, very close to Arbor Day. Trees are such an interesting kind of plant because they are so long lived. I mean, and so when you start with vegetables and like annual flowers, you get, everything happens in one year or less, you know, the burst of growth, the joy of seeing all of that, and then, you know, the demise. And our trees now, which are about the oldest ones, probably, you know, 10 or 15 years old. And I have to say, when you grow a tree and it's something that you see every day, it is really fun to watch it change over time. And that's what an annual or a perennial, unless it's a big woody shrub of some sort, an annual perennial, generally you don't get to experience the plant. I guess I'm not being very articulate, but I'll just give you an example. When you asked about what's growing well, and I've had to do less and less to take care of our trees than any other kind of plant in the garden. And what I mean by that is, certainly with an annual, geez, you got to dote on this thing, you know, especially a vegetable, a lot in the summertime between making sure it gets watered. And out here in Seattle, excuse me, of course, I got snails and slugs and cutworms that I'm dealing with. And snails, slugs, and cutworms are not going to do anything to my trees because the tree is just, it's way bigger. It's probably got, you know, loads defensive compounds loaded up just for, you know, any pest that comes at it. And so I would have to say the only thing I do with my trees is I had an arborist out because I wanted to do a little bit of shaping on a couple of trees. And then one tree had these co-dominant leaders, and you want to take care of things like that in a mm-hmm. tree as well. So with minimal pruning and keeping mulch around the base of the tree, these beings will just grow and grow and grow. And they change over time, and their structure, I think, becomes more beautiful and more defined. And it's funny, I have one tree that it's just, even at like almost 15 years old, it's still kind of a squirt. It's a tupelo. And it's like this rangy teenager. I feel like it's going to be this rangy teenager for probably the first maybe 20 to 30 years of its life. And then it's going to get into maturity maybe around, you know, 40 or 45 years. And you just can't say that about a lot of plants. And there's a book, listeners, if you're tree, you know, if you're a tree person or want to know more about trees, there's a book called the Hidden Life of Trees. I get it mixed up with our book in The Hidden Half of Nature. No, it's The Hidden Life of Trees. A German forester wrote this book, and it kind of says it all about the life of a tree and what they can bring into our lives, and really seeing them as beings that we share this planet with. So anyway, trees, I learned something from my trees, whether I've got them in pots or the ones in the ground. I learned from them all the time. So I'm just kind of in love with my trees at the moment, probably because they're all leafing out as well. And it's such a transformational thing to see this big woody plant that's been bare all winter just start bursting all over with leaf buds. You just think, oh my God, you know, who knew that all this greenery was embedded within all of that wood? And it goes on, you know, year after year.
Aww. I love so much of what you just said. You have no idea how, like, you're touching my heart right now, because I'm such a tree. I was just telling my students the other day, yeah, I practically got kicked out of college my first year as a photography major. At one point, they were like, if you take one more photo of a tree, you're going to fail this class. They're like, you have to take pictures of something else. And I was like, but these trees are maples, and these trees are this, and these trees are that. And, you know, I was like, they're all different trees. And they were like, you have to take pictures of something else. And then my husband and I met back in 1991, because like we had just attacked Iraq during the whatever desert storm, and my friends at college were all like, you should go plant trees, you know, you'll like, you know, it's a very mothering thing, you can connect with nature, and you should get a job. And so I get this job planting trees, and that's how Mike and I met, on a mountainside. We get this huge fight about, he's like, you hippie environmentalist, you all want us to cut down, and he was a logger forever. But anyway, so like, I love trees. And then like, even at our property, like here at our house, because we got married in 93, so we're going to be 24 years now. I have seen the trees. When you watch a tree grow, I sit on my couch and I just love the view from my couch all year long and watch the trees change and the landscape change. And you definitely, I mean, we're on 20 acres and mostly pine trees, so there's not the same growth. But also another thing, my listeners, like Russ Medge, who talks about pruning fruit trees, has been one of my top 10 downloaded. Like, I know they're very interested in that. And I talk about, we put this orchard in 2009, how much fruit I'm amazed we get from the apple trees. Like, Mike always wanted trees and fruit trees, and he talked, and I couldn't believe how many apples we've gotten off of these trees we planted already. Just now, we bought different sizes, and we paid, I think, $200 for two of those trees, because they were like producing already that first year. But then other ones we bought, like, you know, at Home Depot, I think for like $80, you know, just a new smaller tree. And just, I can totally see what you're saying. And we went to this, we took the kids to this Earth Day Festival a couple of weeks ago. And the, I guess Arbor Day was actually yesterday, Friday, April 28th. Oh, okay. But they were giving out trees to the people. So if listeners are thinking, you know, you might, I can't remember who it was, but it's maybe the Montana Arbor Society or somebody was handing out trees that day. But I love the way you're so passionate about it. I'm definitely gonna have to check out that book, The Hidden Life of Trees. And then, you know, I am a tree hugger naturally, and I take photos of kids hugging trees. Like, someday I want to make like a, you know, a coffee table book of like all these pictures. Like, I have these ones of my granddaughter who's in high school now, but when she was like 3 or 4 hugging a tree. And I love everything that you just said. Anyway, my listeners are like, be quiet, let your guest speak. So I just think that was awesome. So what about next year? Is there something you're excited to do next year? Something, or this season could be like the season coming up, something that you haven't tried before that you're excited about?
Well, let's see. I'm not planning on anything new, in part because I don't have any space. You know, that's the difference between having 20 acres and living in a city, is you quickly, you know, stuff your lot full of plants, which is what I've done. And this is the other interesting thing. And these plants get bigger.
Right?
Bigger and bigger. So I just don't have, much space. Oh yeah. Actually, here's something kind of interesting, Jackie. I've noticed in the last couple of years that I probably will, I'd say, be taken advantage of in doing, and that is that the garden's established enough now, and there's certain perennials that I have that are really, really happy with where they are, and they are starting to kick out seeds every year, and some of these seeds conditions are good right around the mother plant in the soil, that I'm getting scads of seedlings of perennials. And I'd say one of the things I want to focus on a lot more is food for pollinators. I have not in the past, you know, when I started gardening, I didn't think about that a lot. And perhaps the plight of the bees was not as serious, you know, 10 years ago as it is now, but I would really like to focus on feeding pollinators. And so one of the things I actually did last year, we lost, unfortunately, a gorgeous tree called a forest pansy redbud. And so that tree died, I removed it, and I've planted 2 more trees in its place. I know that sounds crazy, but they're this really cool new oak that's got a very sort of columnar upright growth form. So it'll fit. It's, the trees are fitting well where the old redbud was. But what I also gained from when that redbud died is there was space underneath it to plant. And so I've dedicated, and it's a fairly small space. I mean, anyway, what I've done with that space beneath the trees, and this is, you know, a note to gardeners out there. The best time to plant perennials, if you want underneath trees, is at the same time as you plant the trees. Because everybody knows, you go digging around a tree, a mature tree, and it's like you pretty much can't, and frankly, you probably shouldn't be digging around in the roots of a tree trying to plant, you know, some plant that you've pulled out of a 1 gallon or a 5 gallon pot. It's just, you're ripping the roots of the tree apart. And so I have this perfect situation, new trees, new perennials. And I have planted, that's where I got my cone flowers. I've got my echinacea. I do really, really well with echinacea. And I had seedlings of echinacea all over the place. And I'm not going to go spend, you know, $5 or $10 on a 1 gallon echinacea at the nursery. I let my little seedlings grow. And after either for 1 or 2 seasons, you know, depending on what my needs are, I'll just pluck them from where they self-seeded, and I'll transplant them right over to where I want them. And I've had, so that's what I'm doing with my echinaceas, is I want to, and I know they do well. I don't have to water them a lot. I don't have to fuss over them. And the pollinators come mid-summer, they are on these echinacea every single day, all day long. So I want to focus on pollinator food, both at the very beginning of the season, right now, because these pollinators, they need food, you know, all throughout the growing season. And so that I would say would be one thing that I really want to focus on more that I have not focused on so much. I think what I'm going to do, Jackie, I have a neighbor right on one side of me and then one maybe six houses away. And the one six houses away, he had been growing vegetables in front of his house. And I said, "Hey, Matthew, what are you doing?" Because he'd ripped it all out. And I'm like, "What are you doing? You're not going to..." No, of course me. "You're not going to pave that, are you?" He's like, no. "I'm going to do a pollinator garden." And I was like, "Oh God, that is so cool." And I said, "Well, how about this? Let's do a pollinator pathway. You plant all your pollinator flowers right here. And I'm going to, work on people between me and you. And we'll get this sort of like connect the dots thing." So that's something that is sort of new on my mind. And the other thing, Jackie, and this is a tip, okay, listeners, listen up. Ground bees. There's mostly probably what we're seeing in our gardens is the standard honeybee, but there are a lot of different kinds of bees, and there's ground bees, and this is where you need to check how much you mulch. These ground bees need to burrow directly into the soil. So if you are mulching everywhere, it's reducing the habitat for the ground bees. So leave little patches of bare ground where you can, and you may be able to attract some ground bees, which are a really important kind of pollinator. And every region has its native ground bees as well. So that's something, especially for me, because I'm so mad for mulching that I have to remind myself, no, wait a minute, find some little corner of the garden that's not going to be prone to erosion and that's not, right at the base of some plant where you want mulch, and make a little space for some ground bees and see if you can get some of them coming in.
Wow. Oh my gosh. You're so full of awesome ideas and just tons of golden seeds. So, I never heard of ground bees. I know in Montana, our native bees are these mason bees. And like, we just had this seed fair and it was like a project they were doing with the kids where they like would roll up like these tiny itty bitty tubes of newspaper into like, and then they would like fill a coffee can through of all these tubes of newspaper somehow. And they called them mason bee hives or something.
Oh yeah.
But oh, that's so cool. I love all those ideas. And making like a pollinator path. That just sounds so cool. I think you've just been the most wonderful guest. I know my listeners are just gonna love this interview. And I have a lot of people interested in urban gardening. And like my brother, so he is on Long Island because I grew up in New York, so he's by my mom, and when I interviewed him, he talked about native landscaping a lot like you are, because him and his wife are both busy and they don't have a lot of time to plant a big vegetable garden. They do a lot of herbs and composting, but they're very similar. Like, he talked a lot about native plants and his episode was downloaded a ton, so I know listeners are going to be really interested in this. Before we get to the root of things, we're going to thank our sponsors and affiliate links. Before we get to the root of things, we're going to take a moment to thank our sponsors, my good friend, Dacia Daly from Simply Josephine.
It's all about handcrafted soaps and apron love here at Simply Josephine. Located in Montana's beautiful Tobacco Valley, I create everything from my home studio. Currently, I offer 6 different kinds of handmade soaps, 3 different salves, using wildcrafted plant medicine from right here in our beautiful valley. In addition to my body care products, I also make several styles of aprons. Everything is available at simplyjosephine.com. We want to share a little love with the Organic Gardener podcast listeners. We're offering 15% off. Use code OGP15 at checkout. Thanks and have a beautiful day. simplyjosephine.com.
Hey, green future growers. Do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get enter to get listening to your first audiobook today. And now, let's get to the root of things. Believe it or not, we're ready to get to the part that I call getting to the root of things, which actually we've been talking for over an hour already. So, and I try to keep it to 35 minutes because, I don't know, it just makes it easier for me to edit and just, but then when I have guests on who are full of valuable golden seeds, which is what I call like, you know, other podcasters call them golden nuggets or value bombs. So I call them golden seeds. And you're just dropping like tons of great tips. And I know, you know, people have talked about mulching, but nobody's mentioned that about leaving a space. But definitely, you know, growing a garden for the pollinators, I just love that. So yeah. Are you ready to get to the root of things?
Yeah.
Okay. So, what activity, like, do you have an activity that's like your least favorite that you kind of have to force yourself to go do in the garden?
Least favorite. Actually, I was doing something yesterday that was really getting me irritated. And that this is what it is. We're food composters. So we have two small worm bins, and that's where all the food waste goes. Because as anyone who's used worm compost knows, I mean, this stuff is like mana from heaven. It is the best kind of compost, I think, especially for a vegetable bed. And we put tea bags into the, into our countertop container. Out to the worm bin it goes. We're big tea drinkers. And it was, what kind of tea? This is a English tea, I think called Yorkshire. And I'm like, I am giving these people a phone call and an email. They're not as bad as United, okay? I'm not going to go that far, Jackie. But these tea bags are half broken down. And let me back up. Last fall, I spread all of my compost, and to my eye, everything looked pretty fully composted. And I thought, over the winter, the rest of this will break down. And no, when I went out to do some planting yesterday evening, I'm looking at my beds and I'm like, what's this little scrap of thing? And that little scrap of thing, what is this? And I'm like, oh my God, these are the remnants of tea bags. And everything else that was put in that worm bin is thoroughly broken down, but not these tea bags. So I have two concerns. First of all, what are these tea bags made of? Maybe we're going to change the kind of tea we're drinking. And I spent probably an hour and a half picking through the top. I wasn't digging things up, but I'm seeing all these remnants of tea bags and I don't exactly now know what this material is, and it's in my food bed. So that was really irritating. And I know that now probably every time I go out to look at the veg bed, I'm going to be like focusing on the search pattern for half degraded tea bags. Because something's weird when you have a tea bag sitting in a worm bin for 6 months and the thing isn't broken down. So that's what's irritating, Jackie, is when you knowingly or unknowingly bring something into your garden and it doesn't play nicely with nature. And that's that is my feeling about those tea bags. So fixing problems like that are not my favorite things to do in the garden.
Remember I told you I couldn't figure out how to record an interview for 6 months. So my very first interview, this guy in my podcasting group, he recorded it, and I just re-interviewed him on my anniversary, and he talked about this worm composting bin, how much it was working for him. He's down in Florida, so you guys couldn't be possibly different sides of the United States. So I was like, I'm gonna get one for my classroom. So I get this worm bin for my classroom, but it was a total flop. Some of the things I realized is like I kind of like had a cardboard cover over it. It definitely needed more air. And then the other problem I had is like I thought we were gonna have tons of compost in the classroom, but we actually mostly have fruit. And then Mike read online that they don't really like, you're not supposed to put oranges in there, and it just wasn't decomposing. It was just turning into rotting food. So, like, do you have some tips for me for what works with yours?
Yeah. Worms get I baby my worms. And it's true that the things that, I mean, eventually they would break down all food stuff, but we're gardeners and we want this compost produced in as short a time as possible. So here's what does not go in my worm bin. Citrus peels, avocado skins, no more of our breakfast tea bags. Weirdly enough, cranberries. They will not, I think cranberries are just way too loaded with some kind of phytochemical and they do not like the cranberries. About every other kind of food that I've put in the worm bin, with those exceptions of those things I just listed, the worms will love. What they particularly love is green leafy matter. And so if I'm out by the
vegetables, that's what Mike
said. Yep, it's green leafy stuff. And in part because I think it's probably just very easy to, it's very accessible to them. It's, and they break it down really, really quickly. So I will, when I'm out, if it's summertime and I've got like a, you know, a lousy leaf on a lettuce plant or something like that, I just take it straight from the veg bed over to the worm bin. And I'm like, you need to go through the worms one more time before I can use you. So I would, banana peels, too many banana peels can make a worm bin slimy. One of the things that I do is in the kitchen. So we have the bowl and I will have torn up scraps of brown paper bags with no glue, no ink, no nothing on them. And I just tear that up into pieces, maybe anywhere from, you know, 3 to 6 inches by 3 to 6 inches. And as I put scraps into the food bowl on the kitchen counter, I layer them with that brown pieces of paper. And then when the bowl's full, take it out to the worm bin. And I've got the paper's nice and dry, and it's also decomposable, right? Paper bags used to be trees. It's plant matter, and the worms will eat that. And so that's how I control for excess moisture in the worm bin. And as far as my worm bins go, like I said, I'm really limited on space. And what I did was you can find all of this stuff on the internet. Here, you can build a 10 foot by 10 foot worm bin. I'm like, I don't have, that's not happening here in the little urban lot. So I went and I got flower boxes, big flower boxes, rectangular shaped. I'd say they're probably 2.5 feet long by about maybe 8 inches wide by about 8 to 10 inches tall. Gardeners will recognize that. And then I drilled holes with a drill, maybe 1/8 to 1/4 inch across, all over the sides of that, the flower boxes. And I have two of those side by side. I've stashed them in between two pots. And then I put a piece of wood, like a seating plank that you could actually sit on if you wanted to, that's across those pots. And so the worm bins are out of sight, but I've got enough clearance to get the top off the worm bins and get all the food matter in there. And it's also kind of key, especially for a gardening application, that you have two bins, because one will be, what I do is I fill one up. I just keep putting more and more food in there, and I, you know, give it the occasional turn just to make sure I'm not getting excess moisture and smelly stuff going on. And I just keep filling that up. And once it's full, I don't add any more to it, and I just leave it alone. And then in the meantime, I will have an empty bin. So I will have one bin filled up, and once that's filled up, I then turn to the empty bin and start filling that up with the same stuff. And generally, by the time I have that second bin filled up, I go take a look at the first bin, and it's mostly decomposed. And that will probably certainly be the case with our warmer weather here, because I've been putting stuff in it, you know, all winter and spring, and, well, actually late winter. And so I should have some nice worm compost, you know, by maybe end of June, beginning of July, something like that. So that's how I deal with worm bin in an urban environment. And I keep, it's really also important in an urban environment, is you don't want raccoons, rats, cats, possums, squirrels, you name it, whatever can, get in there. You want to keep it out. And so I have a piece of plywood that is cut just to the to slightly overlap with the top dimension of the flower box. That's the lid on my worm bin, and I have a brick on top of it. And so, so far, I've had these worm bins over 5 years, maybe going on 10, and I've never had any problem with rodents or anything else getting in there. Whereas I have talked with other neighbors, and they're like, "Oh yeah, I've got the such and such," and I'm like, "Well, is your worm, you know, did you cover that up, or why are you leaving like food scraps right on top with nothing on them?" "Well, I didn't know." No, you gotta really Fort Knox your worm bins in order to keep any unwanted varmints out. The only thing you want in there is your worms, and you'll find, you know, you want your worms and all your microbial life in your worm bin, and that is it. Nothing, no furry mammals in the worm bin.
Okay, so I have two questions. If they're flower boxes, do they have a bottom, or it goes right into the dirt?
Flower boxes, they do have a bottom on them, and I have mine sitting on a hard surface. I got a couple pavers to keep it nice and level, and that just leaches out into the soil. And I happen to also have right by these flower boxes, I have a fence that I made out of dogwood shrub, and so it's a woven fence. It's cool. I'll send you a picture of it. And okay. So my worm bins are feeding my living fence. That's the other thing. If you can set it up that these worm bins, I mean, there is a lot. There's some great nutrients coming out of the bottom of those worm bins, and if you can set those near a plant that would enjoy those, then that's a great thing to do too.
All right, because my mom does have a big problem with animals in hers. We don't. We have two. We used to have two compost bins. I think we're up to like four or six now. So I know that rotating. But Mike has like the little mini farm he planted last year, so that's why. But anyway, and then so I was thinking one of my problems was the lid, but you do have a lid on yours. So do you have like air holes in the lid too?
No.
Mm-mm. Okay. Just the air holes around the sides.
And I mean, I've probably with the drill, there's probably, I don't know, 50 holes that I've drilled into both all sides of that.
Big of a hole? Like a dime or a quarter?
No, nothing like that. It's no bigger than the diameter of a pencil.
Okay. And what was, there was one more thing I was going to ask about. And then probably like in Seattle, like, in Montana, we couldn't really keep it out all winter, I don't think, because they would freeze. I mean, you know, it gets pretty cold, but you probably don't have that. How cold does it get there?
Yeah, we do. Actually, we were gone last winter, but, you know, I was watching the weather, of course, from where we were, where it wasn't much warmer, as a matter of fact. And we got a number of freezes last winter in Seattle and some snow. We will get down to the, it would be a really cold winter in Seattle if we dropped into the high teens, lower 20s, you know, two or three times. So we do, that will happen. I have never had complete die-off of my worm bin, partly because I pack them late, you know, come fall. I guess I have to modify a little bit. Come fall, late fall, I want to make sure I have enough in both worm bins that when the freeze comes, that these worms will all move to the center of the worm bin and avoid getting frozen. And I don't, you know, so that's another way to keep your worm bin going year round. And of course, another thing that a person could do if they were really into this is you could probably fashion some kind of little insulating blanket. And if you were not, and you knew that a freeze was coming up, just go throw the blanket on top, like probably an old moving blanket or something like that. And a place like Montana where, you know, you guys aren't plagued with rain, it's dry snow, throwing an insulating blanket on top of a couple of, you know, flower boxes that you're using as worm bins, say on a back deck or something like that, might provide enough protection to keep them from freezing.
I don't know. I mean, we're way down below zero even for a few weeks at a time, and we're way frozen for most of the winter.
Yeah,
I think you would have to keep it, like, it would have to be indoors.
Yeah, or maybe in a garage or a shed of some sort. That might work, yeah. And if you're if you've got big old compost bins and those are frozen solid in the winter, then you're right. You're probably not going to stave off a freeze of your worm bin if it's in a much smaller
container. No, I think they got to be indoors here. But a lot of my listeners are in warmer climates. So, I mean, most of my listeners are, my three biggest places are California, Texas, and New York, and then Australia.
Those
are pretty much all warmer climates, depending on where you are in, you know, California or in New York, different places. New York gets pretty cold, but Texas is probably warm. And I have a lot of listeners in Florida too.
Those are all places for a warm bin. And depending on where you are in New York, I don't know, maybe, you know, you might be able to squeak by with some attention to, you know, the onset of freezing weather, especially if you're down near the water.
And I did talk to a woman up in Toronto, Canada, who has a business called Kathy's Crawly Composters.
Oh,
I think Creepy Crawly. Do you know her?
I've run into her on Twitter, I think. And it's the, I remember her.
She is so fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's super fun. And so she's doing it up there too. So it definitely works all over the place. I just have to, like, I don't think I put enough air holes and then, like, we kept having, like, melon peels and grapes and, you know, stuff that, like Mike said, he's like, they want to eat the same stuff you throw in your compost. You know, they want, you know, lettuce and more of that. And we just don't have that. It's partly because my kids, what they're eating in the classroom is breakfast. At lunch, they go to the cafeteria, and I'm not getting that waste. Yeah. I'm getting the breakfast lunch. So that was part of the problem.